Stay safe on the roads with Rain-X Vision Beam Wiper Blades. Now at Menards. For over 40 years, Rain-X has provided drivers with products to outsmart the elements. Their Vision Beam Wiper Blades are easy to install and are designed to provide a smooth, streak-free wipe every time. Save big money on all Rain-X products now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. No, Max. So I'm going to lead. This is new territory for me. But it'll be fun.
I'm sure we have ultimate trust that you can pull it off.
Yep.
I didn't hear any sarcasm there at all.
Otherwise, we'll just laugh at you. It'll be fine.
Welcome back, everyone, to a very special Sunday roast where we don't have Max. No one knows where Max is. Please, if you know where he is, if you've seen him anywhere, please let us know. However, we do have a lamp, but we do have two wonderful guests. Zoe, can you please introduce yourself to everyone?
Hi, Alex. I'm becoming a bit of a regular. I think it's third time I've been on Sunday Roast.
We tend
to go
to you when everything's gone a little bit haywire, or well sometimes, in terms of what's going on with immigration.
Exactly. The thing is, I work on the issue that everybody constantly wants to talk about in the news, especially the government. So I get a lot of airtime. So yeah, I am a researcher and a campaigner on migration issues and specifically migrants' rights.
And Regan, please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Regan Ali. I am a YouTuber that covers news and various topics, mainly UK, but sometimes I broaden it out into the world as well. And I've been doing this since March this year, and that's pretty much it, really. I've been doing it for quite a while now, and I'm still learning. I consider the channel more of a learning together, because I'm still learning about news and politics, but hopefully being another voice out there that can help make a difference to people's lives.
I think that's what we're all trying to do, aren't we? We're all trying to make our little difference here and there with a bit of a voice. Although some of us on the BBC seem to be able to absolutely trounce any opposition that come up. I think you took on Gullis, didn't you, as well, in the committee, Zoe?
I had my moment against Gullis in the committee. I had another debate with him on Talk TV at one point. The thing is, like, in the committee, it was great because this was the bill committee on not the most recent anti-migration piece of legislation that the government passed, but the last anti-migration piece of legislation they passed. And this was the committee of MPs that scrutinizes the bill. And the great thing about that space is they have to let you talk. Like, you are there to give evidence. It's not a sort of media debate. So I had to be given the space to respond with the factual evidence to the question he asked me. And that's why that video of me giving that response, everybody's like, this is amazing. It's like, yeah, because we never get the opportunity to give that kind of a factual-based, like, answer to the questions about immigration when we're talking about it in the news.
One then, Chair, which is, if these people in Calais are legitimate refugees, why are they not claiming asylum in France, Italy, Spain or Greece? Why do they need to come to the United Kingdom?
As I'm sure you'll be aware, because I think the previous witness did say this, the vast majority of people who seek asylum worldwide, firstly, 86% of refugees and displaced people worldwide remain in the country neighbouring the one they have fled. So 86% of people remain in developing countries. France received three times as many asylum applications as we did last year. Most people stop as soon as they feel safe. But the people who are making their way to England and who specifically wish to come to the UK do so because they have ties to this country, because they either have served with our military, as in the case of people from Afghanistan, or have family members, as with the Syrian client that I mentioned that JCWI is representing, or speak the language because of our colonial history and have other ties of kinship and history here. So there are people who have legitimate ties to the UK, and there is no good reason why they should particularly have their claims assessed in France if they do not wish to. It doesn't really work for us to say to the French that, given that we're geographically located slightly to the west of you, none of these refugees are our responsibility and they're all on you, because France can say the same thing, and then Italy can say the same thing, and then the entire international refugee protection system will crumble.
Part of the reason why we made this a long format, I mean, we were considering doing an even longer format, because there's some topics that you can't go over in 15 minutes, in half an hour, even an hour. But you know, you got to work within what we've got. Let's talk about Rwanda then. Let's just go straight into it. Like, Supreme Court decision, it's unanimous. It's a check on power. Arguably, you could say the committees are a bit of a check on power because, as you said, you could actually question and they have to answer and they can't avoid topics as well as they could do if they were in Parliament. I mean, Parliament's actually quite useless for that because you could just say whatever you want. But within committee, everyone seems to take it a lot more seriously. Tell us, Zoe, what happened with the call from the Supreme Court?
So this was amazing. It feels so long ago now. There's such good news. It was an amazing week. We had Zoella Braverman out on her ass. Sorry, out on her buttock. And then the Supreme Court ruling. So basically, this is the government's heinous scheme to send everybody who comes to the UK seeking asylum, regardless who they are, regardless where they come from, just send them off to Rwanda for life and that's it. Wash our hands of them. What the Supreme Court found was that they can't do that legally because Rwanda is quite clearly not a safe place for refugees. And they sort of, in this incredibly sort of polite deadpan way that judges do, read out all the ways in which the government should quite obviously have been aware of that. So, for example, Rwanda has a 0% protection rate for refugees from Syria and Yemen and Afghanistan. And Rwanda...
What does that exactly mean for anyone who's...
So that
what
means
does the
that
zero protection rate mean?
If you come from Afghanistan and you've escaped from the Taliban and you go to Rwanda and you say, I'm a refugee, please protect me, there is a 0% rate of them saying, ah, yes, you are clearly a genuine refugee. Let us offer you protection. They have a 100% rate of saying, you don't seem like you really need protection. Go back. So that's obviously not a system that genuinely protects people because quite incredibly obvious, Afghans are very, very often genuinely refugees under the terms of the 1951 Convention and therefore must not be sent back to danger in Afghanistan. So that's one example. There's also, like, you know, the fact that the UK government has had to warn Rwandans here in the UK that they are at risk because the Rwandan government is trying to kill them on the streets. So, the Rwandan government is obviously not a trustworthy partner, not a partner that can be relied upon to respect human rights because they're into extrajudicial killings, which is kind of like a no-no in terms of human rights. So basically, it was all this vast reams of evidence that Rwanda was very clearly not a safe place to be sending refugees. That's what we've seen the government melt down over ever since. And unfortunately, the response is to say, you know, there's a lot of ways they could have responded to this. They could have, for example, said, okay, not Rwanda. Rwanda's not safe. We'll try to set up a deal with somewhere else and send refugees somewhere else. Now, I would still have opposed that because I believe that the UK should take responsibility for our fair share of protection of refugees. But they could have done that if they had found a genuinely safe country, then the court arguably wouldn't have had anything to say about it. But instead, they've decided to say, no, we'll just pass a law that says that actually Rwanda is safe. And then, you know, we win, which... It doesn't work. Work in sort of the realm of objective reality, but it also doesn't work legally because the protections against the reason why there's such a strong protection against somebody from Afghanistan, for example, if the reason why they mustn't be sent to Rwanda if Rwanda won't protect them is that there is an absolute rule under international law and across lots of different parts of international law, but also under what's called customary international law. So basically taken as read, as given. You don't need to be referring to any convention or any treaty. It's just given that you must not send somebody whose life is at risk to that danger.
Like so, LGBTQ plus, for example, having reports come out of Rwanda from both the police and from locals and from refugees, they're not exactly welcome.
Exactly.
That would be a red, wouldn't it?
That would be a no. So this is the issue where you have we can say Rwanda's safe after all. But if Rwanda in actuality is not safe, and if we were to send someone from Afghanistan there and Rwanda says, no, we don't think you're a refugee, we're going to send you back to Afghanistan, then that person, we would be responsible ultimately for that person being sent back to danger in Afghanistan. And that is like your big no-no in international law. You cannot send somebody back to face that kind of danger. Thank God. Mm. And so the government can't just say black is white, and they can't even legislate to say black is white. Black is not white. And so they're going to be trapped, and they're in a situation where they either have to break that really big fundamental rule about sending people to danger, or they have to find an alternative plan.
It'd be interesting to see what they can come up with. Regan, what were your thoughts on last week's announcement from the Supreme Court, especially as it was unanimous as well? That's quite interesting. I think it was 5 judges. Is that correct?
Yeah. It was, I mean, I don't think we should be, I mean, did we really honestly think that they were, that it was going to be any other outcome given it? I mean, I think just, there has been, I know there's been in the past talk about them looking at other nations as potentials, but I just find it just so inhumane, this whole scheme. And it's really disheartening. I mean, they just don't see the humanity whatsoever in these, and they just see them nothing more as numbers. And that's what really, really generally upsets me. And if I mean, even if Rwanda was a safe country for them, it's still not the right and indecent thing to do. Every life is precious, and we need to look after anybody for that matter. And I'm glad that the courts, yes, looked at everything and seeing that this is not right in any way, shape or form. I think it's absolutely disgusting that the British government are trying to look like, oh, they're trying to paint it as if that they haven't lost, and they're just looking at an alternative way to change the law, twist it or bend it to basically say no, we haven't lost the case or anything. That's why they're trying to paint this picture. You know, the right wing media and outlets are trying to say no, we haven't lost the case. It's not like that anyway, shape or form. But they're trying to paint that picture to people, and then just. And what was just as upsetting is I think the day or two after we saw one or two videos where. They're looking at one or two videos I saw online of people basically saying that the immigrants are responsible for what's happening in this country. And I'm just like, that's not the case at all. It really isn't. It really is not the case. And I just hope that God forbid we don't ever have a plane sent of people to Rwanda or indeed any country that they may feel that their lives may be in danger.
There's actually quite a lot to unpick from what both of you said. Zoe, I'm going to play devil. It is a difficult thing, isn't it? I mean, all three of us can see that there's difficulties in all of this. And what do you do? Mm-hmm. I think the numbers and how they number people, which is quite interesting as well. We had that. I think that was brought up in a question time by an audience member being like, oh, Europe should take its fair share. And it's like, we're taking the least, and we've got huge amounts of space, and we've got a shrinking population, and we've got a huge multicultural ethnic group that might be able to help settle some of these people into UK living and lifestyles and the ideas and ethos within the country. And yet it's not looked at that. And I think, Zoe, I am going to come on to the cleverly point. I thought you did a brilliant job when you summarized it and said, it's half of Wembley. We can't deal with half of Wembley a year. Are you joking? Yeah. We can deal with that in an hour.
We deal with it every week when there's
deal with it every week. Match, right? So I'm gonna put on the devil's hat now, which is cleverly said. You know, I did check this. The UNHCR, so the United Nations body for dealing with refugees, is working in Rwanda. What is the reasoning behind that? Like, if the UN is saying we're working with you, and from what I could tell, the pumping of money to infrastructure, into building wells, into education. I've got a theory, by the way, I'll bring up in a minute. And I think it's quite an interesting one. But they're building wells, they're building infrastructure, they're building schools. I think there's some electrical work being built, all financed through the UN. Why is that happening if Rwanda's so bad?
Well, okay, so the UN as a whole and UNHCR, which is the refugee body of the UN, are slightly, well, they're not different. One is part of the other, but the UN is an intergovernmental organization. So every country in the world, including all the really, really, really bad ones where we wouldn't want to send refugees, are members of the UN. So the involvement of the UN in any one individual country says nothing about how good it is of a country in any particular way. Then the fact that UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, works within Rwanda is really interesting, because UNHCR was one of the key witnesses that provided evidence, which is the reason why the Supreme Court said that Rwanda is not a safe country. So they have operational experience. They are there on the ground in Rwanda, working with Rwanda in order to help the Rwandans, basically, to protect refugees. Because exactly as you said about Europe doesn't take its fair share, the UK definitely doesn't take its fair share. The vast majority of refugees around the world are accommodated in countries that are really, really poor, basically, countries that are themselves quite unstable. The two biggest refugee hosting countries in the world at the moment are Turkey and Iran. And so most of the Afghan refugees are actually hosted in Iran. And actually, insanely, a lot of Iranian refugees are hosted in Afghanistan, right? Because people, generally speaking, stay in the country closest to the one they've just fled. People don't tend to flee very far in most cases, right? So a lot of refugees are hosted in Rwanda, and the UN operates schemes where Rwanda, as compared to, say, Afghanistan, is more capable of hosting refugees. So it does help to share responsibility, and it is part of those schemes to do that. And that involves building capacity in Rwanda and also sometimes bringing refugees to Rwanda. The very big difference between that and the UK palming off our responsibilities as one of the richest countries in the world onto one of the poorest countries in the world, Rwanda, and sending all of the people who are seeking asylum in the UK to Rwanda against their will, is just completely different. And James Cleverly or anybody else who pretends to think that that is the same is having a laugh. Like, no, everybody can see the massive difference between the UK palming off our responsibilities and bribing a poor country like Rwanda to take in all of our refugees, and the UN operating a system to share responsibility among the poor countries of the world who host the vast majority of refugees in the first place, including Rwanda.
It was interesting to see his response to that as well, because this is why I wanted to ask you specifically as an expert, because I thought you might be able to dismantle James Cleverly's points better than the Sky News presenter did, who didn't. He seemed a bit stumped when Cleverly brought that up. I mean, Cleverly even brought up at the time that he felt that people were being racist to Rwanda. And you were like, you've got an immigration policy that's clearly racist at your backing, and now you're complaining about people being racist to Rwanda.
What's racist? I'm sorry, but this drives me absolutely insane. First of all, what's racist is the fact that our immigration policies vastly, vastly harm people who are Black and brown far, far more than they harm people who are white. That's racist in the first place. Another thing that's racist is that because we're rich and we have old colonial tendencies, we think we can just pay off countries around the world who are poor and who are developing and whose populations are Black and brown to take care of the other Black and brown people that we don't want here. That is racist. And it's not racist to point out that Rwanda is not a democracy, not a safe country, not a government that can be trusted, a government that perpetrates human rights abuses on a massive scale. In fact, it would be racist to pretend otherwise just because they're Black. That would be absurd. Sorry, it drives me absolutely.
No, don't.
I just lost it, but that makes me mad. Like, the idea that the people opposing the mass forced deportations of Black and brown people from the UK are the real racists. I mean, that really gets my goat.
Just to add to that, I mean, as well, like, we don't even have a legal route for people even to come to the UK as it is there? I mean, that's why there's so many people sitting on along Calais and that trying to get across. I mean, you know, the whole... We know that the whole stopping the boat scheme can be ended overnight just by building the French government said they're willing to help invest for us.
You're talking about a processing center.
That's
there.
It. Thank you.
Do you
yes.
think it's important when we talk about a processing center in France? Because it sounds like the solution. I think what we need is to process people who want to come to the UK, who are in France, to bring them across here. But then their asylum claims should be heard in the UK, not in France. And I think that that's really important. So the French did offer that they would set up a facility there. I don't know how much of that was sort of rhetoric, playing the politics, knowing it wouldn't really happen. But regardless, I think a facility where people's actual asylum claims are processed there is quite dangerous as well, because it's still overseas. Mm. Our legal representatives, our legal system, you know, very hazy how it would operate there. So totally agree that we should cooperate with the French in order to process people who want to come to the UK, but then their claims should be heard in the UK. And as you say, exactly as you say, we could end the need for people to take the boats overnight if we just provided that safe route for them to cross from France to the UK. You and I take the Eurostar, you and I take the ferry. We can offer them the exact same thing.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that level of hypocrisy, because you also hear a number of them, including Mogg, turn around and say something to the effect of, oh, we don't want people dying in the boats. And it's like, well, you can solve that. It's quite simple, but you don't want to because you think that'll start encouraging people. And what you're trying to do is palm it off on the rest of Europe to deal with a problem that's global. It's just a joke. It's not the Britain I grew up with. This is like, but then, you know, we can also turn around and say there's a lot of subtle stuff that's hidden in the background that you don't see, and it doesn't come to the forefront in terms of people's views on races, on cultures, on ethnicities, on nations. But it was interesting as well to see, I don't know, I think I brought it up with you guys before we came on air. Farage got, in my opinion, got pretty nailed to the wall by Nella Rose on, and I'm sure many people are boycotting the program. Go ahead, boycott it. I'm not watching it. I'm just finding clips on I'm a Celebrity. But the most interesting thing came on when GB News tried to counter what Nella had done to Farage, where she basically said, I'm an immigrant and you're saying I shouldn't be here because I'm an immigrant. She's born in Belgium, but a thick South London accent. And raised here from a young age, from what I can tell, immediately from birth. So like, she is British and London. I mean, you might as well say that Boris Johnson's American. What conservative's going to turn around and say that? It's the same sort of principle, of course, as hypocrisy. But it was interesting as well afterwards. GB News came to the rescue of Farage almost immediately from that conflict happening on screen, which looked like a disaster for Farage, in my opinion. And they got Jim Davidson, a stand-up comedian, to come on air to try and defend it. And Jim, partway through, basically said how great Farage was and how he's a great person because he can eat a penis on a piece of pizza. That was the first bit that was really weird. But the second bit was, because Nella was born in Belgium, he said, well, you know, this is typical Belgians. And the presenter had to jump in and go, no, 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 I've just come from Belgium. Belgium's really nice. And it's like, we've got no problem with that. And it's like, they just lost Sainsbury's and they've now just allowed someone on to defend someone who, oh, that was the other flip around. Jim Davidson tried to suggest that Nella was the real racist.
Oh, of course. It's exactly like Cleverly. It's exactly like, you know, if you oppose sending refugees to Rwanda, you're the real racist. It's just intellectually so dishonest. I mean, I haven't watched the clip. But yeah, I mean, it's always this sort of, they in GB News, obviously, all they do is they try to tie it in knots and try to like do all this gotcha. You know, none of it is about actually sitting down and being like, right, what do people feel about this issue? What are the real problems they have that drive these feelings? And what are the kinds of solutions that could bring about a change, that could bring about the best outcome for most people? Like, none of this debate is predicated on any of that. It's about getting your guy out front. It's about getting the most clicks. It's about getting the most views. It's about getting the most funds from the most dodgy, you know, funders in order to run your political career and get power. And that's all it's about. It's like, none of this is about helping people, not British people, not migrants, certainly not refugees.
Yeah, it's about painting a narrative, painting a picture to make people think that this is the issue. This is the main issue. You know, whatever's going on in your life, no, this is what's really happening in the country. And that's something that they always do. I mean, sometimes maybe talk TV aren't always like that, but most times they are. I mean, I just outright avoid both of them, just because I just don't want to be fed such a terrible narrative, because I just don't see their news or information helpful or something that's going to make a difference to me or my life or anybody's lives for that matter. I just feel like they're just trying to stir up hatred amongst people to give people a reason to bicker and argue amongst each other rather than working together to solve issues in this country. That's just all I see GB News is, really.
That's why we all try and get everyone to hail the lamp. It's a unifying product. It'll bring a community together.
Something to bring us all together at last.
But we also have an
all. Oh my gosh, now we have a rival leader. We'll be divided again.
Blasphemy. blasphemy to bring that on. There is something else that I was going to bring up with Rwanda as well. Are you aware that I think Amnesty International and the UN and a couple of human rights organizations, plus several British newspapers, are showing that the Rwandan government is financing a group of rebels in the Congo called M23, and that the foreign secretary for Rwanda is linked as a lead to M23. Are you aware of this? And so not only that, I then dug around because I was like, so they seem to be wanting all this money to come in from the UN for infrastructure, and they're sponsoring a rebel group on their border. I thought, well, what does that rebel group want? What is their actual aim? And there was something really interesting in what they were claiming through social media and a couple of other platforms and from interviews. That M23 group that's operating in the Congo, sponsored by the Rwandan government, wants a territorial expansion and wants part of the Congo to go over to Rwanda. They also want the Rwandan government to take refugees, specifically the Tutsis, who were one of the groups that were badly affected during the genocide in Rwanda, into the Congo. And I'm sort of going, I'm happy to say that this is me going off the deep end and I'm wrong. You know, someone proved it to me, I was wrong, I'm fine. But it seems to me they're getting foreign investment in, building up their infrastructure, and they're sponsoring with that money a bunch of terrorists whose aim is to remove those refugees at a later point, so they're left with all the infrastructure. I'm going, look, I could be completely wrong, but I've never heard of a terrorist group demanding that a group of refugees be taken into another country. And we're clearly sponsored by that country, by Rwanda. Am I going mad here? Is this like going down the rabbit hole too much? Or is this just like, I feel everyone's being heavily played and the Rwandan government are making money from the UN, from the UK, and anyone else who's chucking cash? Israel financed some of the infrastructure projects in Rwanda to take refugees.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to bring that up because I don't know about your theory, but it could be true. I mean, what I would say is that what we know for sure is that Rwandan government is not a trustworthy partner. And we have that evidence from, like, they had this deal with Israel. It was very similar to what we are proposing to do. Israel said, we're going to send our refugees, the people who come seeking asylum in Israel, we're going to send them to Rwanda. You're going to take care of them. We're going to pay you. You're going to give them a place to live. Rwanda says, yeah, great, send them over, give us the money. And then it turns out what they were doing was they were forcibly beating those people up, taking away their papers and kicking them out of the country. So we know that the Rwandan government has precedent of doing exactly what you're saying, Alex, like taking the money, signing the deal, presenting themselves as a humanitarian partner on a deal like this with a richer country, and then screwing over the people. And you know, there being nothing to be done about it. And like, let's be clear, we've already sent the Rwandan government £140 million at least. We don't know what else, because we've also built, you know, these big asylum compounds. You know that awful picture of Suella Braverman doing You know, that's all stuff that our British money has paid for to build, right? We're proposing to pay per person individually to bring every single one of these refugees over to Rwanda, pay for their integration, their education. That's jobs. That's loads of money for the Rwandan economy. So whether they were to then eventually, I mean, I think it's quite evident that the refugees wouldn't be safe there, but whether like some of them would be able to stay, or whether there is a dastardly plan to literally like deport them all en masse, who knows? Whatever happens, as we know, the Rwandan government is absolutely laughing here. They've laundered their image. They've prevented the UK government from being able to criticize their human rights record. And they've made a ton of money off of us to boot. And what have we got out of this? What have our communities got out of this? And what have refugees got out of this? What solution has been found on the basis of this? This is all just the Rwandan government absolutely playing everybody else. It's ridiculous.
Like Zari said, it's entirely possible. I mean, it just all stinks of corruption. Nothing feels right at all when the way Zari breaks it all down like that. It's just like, I don't know what really more to add than what she's already said. I mean, it is infuriating that our taxpayer money is just kind of just going down the drain. I mean, and as crazy as it sounds, as you said, to like 180 million, but it would not surprise us long after, God willing, that we have the Conservatives are gone at the next general election, and there's more investigations and more corruption, and what the Conservatives have been doing behind closed doors, and that we find out. Obviously, the money that's we've already know that's been wasted by British government here in the UK, but how much has obviously has been wasted abroad by them as well. I dread like the total numbers, because we're probably talking like trillions and trillions of British taxpayers' money wasted on a global scale. Never mind just what's happening in Rwanda. So it's
you're absolutely right to say that. I mean, we have already got lots of deals that we're part of. So they're presented as EU deals with other countries. They're called migration management partnerships. Basically, it means you keep your people in a prison. You don't let them leave the country and make their way potentially over to Europe or over to the UK. And that involves funding dictatorships to the tune of millions and millions and millions and millions of pounds. And we are party to those deals and pay for that. And that's outside, that's all around the world. It doesn't work. It obviously kills people. It obviously props up dangerous regimes that create the instability that people inevitably have to flee from. So it's obviously counterproductive. But also, I mean, here in the UK, if you look at the situation, government decided a couple of years ago they were going to stop processing people's asylum claims because they were going to send everybody to Rwanda, in theory, right? They knew that there were massive obstacles to that ever happening. But in the meantime, they said, we're going to pile people up in the asylum system and we're going to put them into hotels. And that's been extremely convenient for a couple of private hotel owners and contractors who run those hotels. And Clear Springs is just one of these private companies. They've been running these contracts to run these hotels in terrible, despicable conditions for asylum seekers. They've just announced profits this year, profits of 65 million pounds. And that is money that has gone from the public purse directly to them in order to house asylum seekers in misery, in squalid conditions. And that's gone out of the public purse right now. It belongs to these millionaire owners of this private company, right? So this is actually it's much more than just cruelty for the sake of the political theatre of it for refugees, which is, of course, very beneficial to the government as well. It's also about enriching, taking money out of the public purse and enriching private companies through totally unnecessary policies like keeping refugees for years at a time in a hotel room. We don't need to do that. We could put that money into local authorities to provide decent housing. We could be making asylum decisions much faster to get people through the systems so they're not reliant on that housing for so long. There are tons of ways in which we can do this in a not-for-profit way that keeps the money from like our public purse in our communities in order to support newcomers. But instead, it's been used to extract that money out. And that's, I'm not going to go on about all the numbers and all the companies, but like surveillance equipment, technology for border equipment, training of border guards. All of this is an industry. All of this is jobs. All of this is profit. And it is so entrenched within our systems that the cost of keeping people out falls upon obviously the people who are killed by those policies, but also upon, you know, the British taxpayer, the European taxpayer, and the profit of keeping people out and pushing people back is raked out of the system by these private company owners.
You know that the IEA was actually purporting to have a privatized police force in one of their recent documents. Anyone aware? It was like hidden in the text. I'm a nerd. I read way too many boring documents.
I missed that one.
And you're like, they want to privatize the police force. I looked at it and I thought,
should we be
aware of Wagner, the Wagner group, the privatized military that almost attempted a coup and could have got away with it with a bit more support? I mean, it's just like, there's something else to talk about with Putin, by the way, which is absolutely nuts and another little bit of a conspiracy theory, but we won't go in that direction yet because we've got a few other topics that we want to talk about. The corruption is just normalized. I often said, Max has said it as well, who's not here, that the best bank loan, the best use of a bank loan he could make would be to go and donate it to the Tory party. Put in £5,000, you could get £1 million contract and do nothing, do absolutely nothing, still keep the money from the contract, even though it has failed. And we've got the bare countless minimum, examples. Sorry, Regan.
I was just saying, doing at least the barest of minimums of whatever that job is to make it look like that they're actually doing something when in fact they're doing absolutely nothing. And then legal corruption, I think.
And then use part of that money to hire the solicitors that'll scare you from wanting to sue them. I think money did that. The solicitor said, if anyone comes out and suggests that she has committed fraud or connected to that, we will consider that defamation. And you're like, that's a threat. You've literally just threatened people by even thinking that she's committed fraud. And you're going, that's what you could do. It's such a twisted system. Let's move on a little bit, because obviously they've moved on from immigration and they're now going for disabled people, saying 2.5 million people could work. It's not that it's quite nuanced as well. They're not like they're saying there's a group of people that are taking advantage of the system. I think the number is about 0.3% statistically, which is shown year on year. And you're always going to have some level of corruption taking place within any system. The irony of me saying that is we've literally just talked about the government being completely corrupt, and we can see it, and they're doing it in millions. But there's almost this thing, and it's quite as Eddie Izzard comment and thinking. It's almost like if you rip people off for millions, the conservative government sort of look at it and go, oh, millions? Bravo, well done. That's quite impressive. Keep the money. Like you've done something right there. Regan, do you have any thoughts on this new attack on this new group?
I mean, I just don't understand why we have to attack people who, where is the, again, they have to talk about the humanity of this thing. I mean, these are people who, there are all sorts of reasons, all sorts of disabilities of why they cannot work. There are all sorts of reasons behind it. Some of them who are probably immobilized, stuck on a bed and they can't move. Some who can barely just walk up to the kitchen. There's some of all sorts of different abilities, both physically and mentally. There's some that can't even sit down and look at a computer for too long, and perhaps maybe might have an attack or something. Yeah, from it. But it just feels like the DWP are being not so. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's the staff, because the staff have to be ruthless because of the targets that they're set upon them. And if they don't do it, they're just going to get pushed aside and someone else is just going to end up taking that job. And it's really cold hearted. I think James O'Brien had somebody who either was an ex or wasn't working at department at DWP, basically saying like if he doesn't do it, if he doesn't meet certain targets, he's just going to get pushed aside. And you just think to yourself, I feel just as much for them, the workers, as well, because at the same time they're trying to help them, but at the same time they're in an impossible situation. And I don't understand why we have to force people with disabilities into jobs that they clearly are incapable of doing any kind of work. Like, where, again, no humanity, no human kindness whatsoever, just inhumane cruelty on the highest level, really.
I think it also has to take into account the lack of support. I mean, one of the interesting things they did say is that they want to support people psychologically. And I get the impression that I'm fully aware that the system they've got at the moment for NHS psychological support through a psychiatrist or a counsellor is 6 months. But if you've got a permanent issue that you feel is affecting you mentally, then it might not be just 6 months. You could have it for your life. And yet there's no system in place to help with people like that. I mean, you look at the military. PTSD does not disappear overnight. It does not disappear in 6 months. And people who have suffered PTSD in childhood, that is more likely to be throughout your entire life. You're going to have to live with that and learn coping mechanisms more than you're going to be able to resolve a lot of the stuff. And I know you wanted to talk about this in relation to depression as well, Regan. Have you got any thoughts on what I've said?
Yeah, I mean, it just ties into like this, obviously the announcement from the Chancellor and trying to push people into work. I mean, obviously, as you said, there are a small proportion of people who choose not to work. And obviously, yeah, we want to try and encourage everyone to work, but there's also a way of doing it. I would almost go as far as what the government are trying to do is basically forced labor, isn't it? It's almost, I would almost go as far as possibly even calling it slavery, because trying to push them into this situation. And
from a personal level, I would say indentured labor, as opposed to slavery. I think sorry, I'm being pedantic here, but I'd say indentured labor more than I would slavery on that, which sort of has connotations of you're forcing them in, and if they don't do it, then they're going to get punished. Would that be more?
Yeah, I mean, they'll have their benefits taken away from them if they don't do it, if they don't meet a certain need. And also, there's the other caveat to this as well, is that businesses are going to take advantage of this. This is an advantage that businesses are going to take of. This is like, oh, if we're going to take these people in, we don't have to pay anything. The government's going to pay us to take these people in, and it's free labor for private companies to get them to do these jobs. And then, obviously, ideally, you would want them to eventually get the job and be part of working for that company. Yeah, you would be ideal. But I believe because I've spoken with Lee Korn about it before, and we were saying, like, what tends to happen. I think they tried schemes like this in the past, and what was happening with private companies is that they were letting them go before the end of the term, and just bringing in a bunch of new free labor, so they didn't have to take them on, and they've been working all that time, don't get any pay from it. The only money they get is getting from their universal credit and that was it. And then obviously from the mental health side of things, you know, as they're stuck in this cycle, not having a way out whatsoever from this. And it just can be such detrimental, and it could lead down that path, depression, anxiety, all those emotions can come into play. And then it could, God forbid, lead to suicide, because that's the, unfortunately, where they go down, especially if there are people in these situations who don't have friends, don't have families or colleagues that are there to support them from an emotional point of view, who are in these situations. It
very much comes back to that thing of a bubble. I think a lot of them are used to the fact that they've lucked out and they've earned their millions, and they've got a cushion in case it goes wrong and can afford private healthcare.
Hmm.
Or they're in such a bubble that they've always got a family that they think will always look after them and protect them, and they won't have an issue. Zoe, I can see you nodding away there at this.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what you said about it. Just being, it feels inhuman. And I think this is where, again, like there are narratives that have a lot of strength, whether it's saying, oh, these people shouldn't be coming here talking about migrants, or whether it's saying, oh, these people shouldn't be scrounging and talking about people who are on benefits. And they do have a lot of power politically. But I think that actually, we've ever since 2010, you know, we've had these cuts and these cuts and these cuts and this demonization. I think the country as a whole understands that you can't keep cutting away people's life support, which is what benefits are, to nothing. And I think that it sort of reflects this incredibly hollow understanding of what a human being is and what their value is. Like, some people bring huge value to the economy, right? They like can work with amazing skills or whatever it is, whether they have like a huge entrepreneurial spirit and they start business, and all of those things are great. But like, every single one of us knows that in our life, the things that bring value, the people that bring us value, it's got nothing to do with their job, right? People bring us value because they're human beings, because we care about each other and we need each other and we depend on one another. And the idea of like placing people who are long-term sick or long-term disabled or have other reasons why they're struggling to find that kind of way of being valued in society, of having a job and producing under the capitalist system, to diminish their value as human beings, to say, well, you're not worth them paying these benefits to, right? That is absolutely destructive in terms of like our own narrative about our own society, what we believe a human being is worth. And like, there are people who are expensive to the state, right? There are people who cannot produce in the way that capitalism requires it, and they shouldn't have to, and we should support them, even if it's very expensive, even if they need long-term and like intricate mental health care, physical health care. We are one of the richest countries in the world, and we're decent bloody people. And like, this idea that we just can't be kind to people who don't produce in the way that capitalism requires them to is absolutely, it's so sickening, but it's also just not true. We absolutely can support those people, and we should. And all of us love people for things that are so much more important than the monetary value they bring to the economy.
It's funny because you're bringing up almost verbatim what Marx said in Das Kapital, and was one of his big criticisms of capitalism. So this is like, is over 100 years old, and we're still fighting over this issue that was noted in, you know, a prolific book. There's no arguing about that, where he's literally saying people don't want to be thrown away and considered worthless. Like, people generally don't. They want to feel as if they've contributed and they've built something, they've created something. So also one of his critiques with mass manufacturing, that you're only seeing one part instead of building a whole, as it were. Mm. And it's interesting to see that, you know, this is that same Tory government. I mean, there's so many Victorian comparisons. We said it in last week's show. They brought back diseases that haven't existed since the fucking Victorian age. Diphtheria, rickets. How do you bring back rickets? Measles, eradicated in 2016 and under the Tories, brought back. I mean, it's like take control of viruses. I think Allshort said that. Take control of diseases, British diseases. And you're looking at it and you're going, you failed. You failed on so many metrics. And what I end up not understanding, you know, because they have got, I mean, in between them attacking, something I just realized, in between attacking immigration, they attacked homelessness, said they were going to take their tents away, and they've now moved on to disabled. And the only thing, again, we were saying off air, I don't think they'll attack the pensioners because they need their votes. The biggest irony is they tried to restrict democracy with voting IDs, and it affected disproportionately the people that voted for them. And Mogg even came out and said it backfired on us. So he knew exactly what he was doing. And you're just looking at this and you're just going, did they read Oliver Twist and miss the point? I can't figure out how some of them can claim that they're religious and they're Christian and then have this heartless, mean, disgusting viewpoint on people who are less fortunate. I think there's this thing that's brought up earlier. You were talking about money and numbers. Maybe that's just how they look at the world. They look at it in numbers. Rishi Sunak's spreadsheet, if it's not the spreadsheet, it can't be real. There's all sorts of elements to this that makes you go, are they just... And, you know, we were talking about gaslighting. That's a narcissistic tendency. That's a psychopathic tendency. And the way they're treating the poor and the sick, you're like, again, we've mentioned it all the way through this. The Rwanda scheme, that was a Nazi policy. Taking homeless people or disabled people and forcing them to work, Nazis had a similar policy to that. And then you're looking at the way that they're treating people that they see who seem to be more unfortunate in life more than anything else. They seem to be following some sort of crazy social Darwinism. They've got, it's almost like, oh, they've ended up in that position, that's their own fault. There was even a quote from a Tory MP that said, she was on Sky News, I can't remember her name, unfortunately, but she said it's their duty to work.
That Treasury Minister, I think it was. Was it the Treasury Minister?
Go on, Regan.
But I just wanted to add that as well, when you were saying about the homelessness, obviously that was, there was that story from Camden Council where it was outside, there were tents set up outside a NHS hospital or a clinic of some sort. And I even covered it on the video as well, where I basically showed the clip of basically the rubbish, basically them throwing the tents into the bins.
Oh my God. Oh my God, this is disgusting.
And originally, when the story came out and when I covered it, it basically said nobody had taken, had basically said who was actually responsible for actually pushing them and moving them along. And in fact, it was actually the council that admitted that they were the ones that were doing it. And I think they were given the green light by Suella Braverman when she was saying that homelessness is a lifestyle choice. That gave, in my opinion, gave Camden Council to give them the green light to do that. I know that there was obviously people were saying that there was issues that the hospital or the clinic itself, they were saying they were having, they weren't comfortable with them being there at the same time as well. But I just think it's just like, and some people were saying in the comments when I talked about it, they were saying, oh, but if they had Palestinian tents, would that have been a different story? And I'm just thinking, whether they have, what difference does it make? They're still human beings at the end of the day. It doesn't matter. Like, they're just going to end up going somewhere else, you know? And I just, yeah, I mean, just the one on the homelessness, like the tents, and then for the tents to be removed after the former Home Secretary was saying that, I just, like, just what gives you, I mean, it's just sickening to my stomach, the council, to admit that they've done that. Like, at least, at least give them like somewhere, accommodation or something, but don't just throw them out on their arse like that. It's just despicable, you know, to say the least.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you say about, like, I mean, there's this thing that's going on, like we're talking about different scapegoats of society, right? Basically, that the horrific Tory party would like realize that they need to win some kind of vote off the back of hatred of some group. But I think it's very interesting how they're sort of like, now they're mixing them together and they're trying to chop and change. So like when Suella Braverman made her statement about, you know, the lifestyle choice of being homeless, she tried to emphasize, oh yeah, a lot of them are foreign, you know. And like when they talked about cutting benefits for disabled people, they're like, yeah, because otherwise we'll have to bring in foreigners, you know. And it's like this constant chopping and changing of like, yeah, you hate this group, but don't forget there's always the other threat of the other group behind this. And it's because not one of these groups actually stands up to scrutiny. And exactly as you say, if you take away their tent, they don't disappear. If you take away people's safe route to get to the UK, they don't disappear, right? People actually need solutions. And that's what this government's totally incapable of providing. So they have to keep baiting and switching and moving around the debate. They're having a totally dishonest debate that like it says, oh, hang on, you were getting somewhere with your argument there. Wait, look over there though, where that person might actually be Black. Like, really, really, now you've got to worry. No, but hang on a second, is that person really disabled? Wait a moment, when you talk about, you know, homelessness, are these people really making the choice to be on the streets? You know, like this constant switching of it around, because if you actually pin them down, they've got no solutions, they've got nothing to offer us.
It's interesting you brought up putting them in homes. I mean, this is one of my big things. Build more houses, that's it.
My god, build more houses. You can build more homes.
We had a discussion about this last week, and there was a went to and fro because people was on the chat were saying, who were also on the show were saying that we don't have the materials, we don't have the ability to do it. And I'm like, there are technological advances that we've got now that can do this, that can speed it up or shrink costs, anything to get the property numbers up. We need, according to Crisis, 400,000. Labour have only offered 150,000.
I read this really interesting article. Sorry, just to jump. Because it was really, really interesting about how the quality of new builds has also taken a nosedive. Like, firstly, we're not building enough. But secondly, like, there's no controls, basically. There's no oversight over the quality. And the competition in construction firms has completely gone out the window since Brexit. So the ability of somebody to bring over, like, some skilled workers from Poland who have the skills to build a house properly has completely disappeared. And now what we have is these temporary, really short-term restrictive visas to bring in temporary migrant workers and people in the construction industry, often relying on the cheapest labor they can possibly find, which is often people who don't have the right to be working in the UK and so have no ability to complain about any conditions that they're subject to and whether they're being paid enough. But they also don't necessarily have the skills and the training and the up-to-date technologies of how to build things adequately. And it's all just cutting corners. So it's not just, I mean, most importantly, couldn't agree more. My God, do we need desperately for them to build new homes? But they also need to have quality, and we need to be bringing in the skills and creating an industry where the skills and the oversight is there to produce good quality, sustainable housing for us as well.
I totally agree. And it's interesting to also bring up what you both said about scapegoats. That's what every dictator has done to have control of the population. I could list Putin. I would love to bring up the Putin story. I'm like, there's something really weird going on over there at the moment, which has shocked me. I think I'll tell you guys off air, which I've noticed. But yeah, with the housing, that's the solution. If you can increase housing, you can reduce rent. People got more money in the pocket. I don't think it should be allowed that 50% of your wage is going into paying for the rent.
Yeah, rent control. And any like responsible press, and I really think the media has a lot to answer for here, because we have so many media outlets that have like counters every single day will tell you how many refugees arrived on the southern coast of Britain. But there is no media outlet that I'm aware of that is counting up the deficit between the number of homes that we need in this country and the number of homes that are getting built. There is nobody who is putting this at the forefront of the conversation, but it's impacting all of us to a massive degree. Whereas I'll tell you, like 40,000 refugees, not impacting all of us to a massive degree. The lack of housing, like 400,000 or whatever it is per year lacking in housing, right, that is impacting every single one of us in massive and important ways. And yet the media doesn't seem interested in this, and I find it really shocking.
Do they all own
their house and they're done outright, or what is it?
There was an interesting clip a couple of weeks back where a newspaper interviewed locals saying what their thoughts are on immigration. And it was really interesting. They kept saying, oh, we can't get a house and it's the immigrants' fault. They get a house instantly. It's like the media have created an equation where 2 + 2 = 10.
Yeah, you can't get a carer either, can you, for your grandma? That migrant that you needed to do the care for your grandma, they may also need a house. So call me crazy. Let's build the houses we need for our population rather than trying to shrink our population to fit an outdated housing stock. It's insane. Like,
Nella brought that up with Farage. He was saying, oh, we want to get rid of, you know, he didn't say he wanted to get rid of immigrants, but he was saying he wanted to reduce immigration. And Nella had to point out, one, she was a migrant, and two, if you pulled out all the migrants from the NHS, social care, who's going to be left? Who's going to be left? We've got a shrinking population. It's 1.56 per family. So you're going, right, per parental couple. So you're going, that's not replacing itself. Japan had the same numbers. Shinzo Abe went in. I say this probably every other week now. He did a load of stuff to increase GDP. He did it individually, but it didn't solve the economic problem. The only resolution is to get more people to have kids or immigration. And if you want people having more kids, fine. But it's going to take, it's not like instance. It takes years.
I don't think that's a reversible trend. I don't. I mean, obviously, there are things you could do. You can make it less incredibly expensive to have a child and so on. But I don't think there's any evidence that you can actually reverse that trend. But that's fine, because you know what? If we weren't so fucking racist, then immigration would be a perfectly fine solution to that, right? Like, people need like a safe place with opportunities to live, and we need workers, that we need each other. That is going to be the theme, where like human beings need each other, right? And I mean, like, if you look at Italy, it's even more extreme. Italy has a replacement, like a deficit in the replacement rate that's even higher than ours. Italy is in a situation where there are villages in Italy and islands of Italy where they will literally pay you to go and live there because they need the population so desperately. And if you're a couple who are planning to have kids and you'll live there for 10 years, they will give you a house and they will pay you a salary to live in that place. But bloody hell, you best not be African, right? Like, they're at the same time, they elect a fascist who wants to turn back all the boats and put a military blockade in the Mediterranean. Like, make it make sense.
It's interesting as well, because they got a new, well, he's not prime minister, he got 25% of the vote, but the guy in charge is like a Tommy Robinson supporter.
Hello, England. How are you today? Mrs. May, your prime minister, prevented me to come to London today. She probably didn't like my speech last time. Shame on you, Mrs. May. But here I am anyway. And I'm honored to speak to you again. You are all heroes. And let me ask you, can Tommy count on you?
Like, there's actual clips of him saying how much he loves Tommy Robinson. Argentina, you've got a guy who's absolutely doolally. He's going to be in charge of that economy. He's going to crash it. I can tell you that now.
This is Javier Milei, Argentina's new far-right president, a former tantric sex coach who reportedly seeks political counsel from his cloned dogs, with whom he has claimed to communicate telepathically. He is pro-gun, anti-abortion, and wants to legalize the trade of human organs. He also thinks climate change is a socialist lie, and has called sex education a Marxist plot to destroy the family.
So you're going, this movement to the right seems to be going there. I might advocate that the EU is stopping it from getting completely out of hand, because PSI, compared to what it was like in the 1930s, so PSI in Poland is now out the picture and gone. Meloni is calming down on what she's saying in terms of rhetoric. Orban is isolated and looks like, because he was relying on Poland to stay in and as a partner, now he's isolated. It actually looks like there's a big change taking place. Regan, do you want a thought on that?
Well, also, Marine Le Pen is still, you know, the gap it was closing on the last French election, wasn't it? So she's not going away either. That's also the cause concern, especially for France there. And there was also that story a couple of weeks ago, wasn't there? A couple of weeks ago in Portugal about the Prime Minister. Was it the Prime Minister or the President? I can't quite put my finger on it. There was a corruption of some sorts taking place there. And then obviously you have what happened in Spain not too long ago with the Catalonians possibly getting back into power, and the Spanish people are up in arms about that. And then, as you said about the what you were saying about the EU and how they're not corrupt, is because it's so big and it's so vast. You need to have, like, they need to have the vast majority of control from the vast majority of EU nations in order to break up the European Union. But still, it is still at its core, still for the good. Mm. And I don't just think that the European nations need, the world needs the EU more than ever before to stand united against these far right fascists that are going to bring so much chaos and so much harm to people, because people are buying into all these rhetorics, these right wing stories, these fear mongerings from all these different world leaders. And these stories are working, and when people's lives are getting worse, or if they're seeing their family and relatives' lives not as good as they should be, or if they want it to be better, they will look to blame someone. They will look to blame, finger blame anything and anything. And when they see someone standing up there on the podium saying, "I'm going to make things better to you," Trump, whatever you might think of that guy, he was saying, "I'm going to make America great again." It was a catchphrase. It made sense. It appealed to people. And as crazy as that guy is, he's still appealing to people now. Yeah. And it's not, and it's in everybody, and all those far right leaders and that from different parts of the world, they're taking that same concepts and applying it into their nations. And over time, people are turning and twisting, thinking, "Yeah, I'm going to vote for this guy because, you know what, my life should be better. And I don't think, yeah, this guy or this person is going to make a difference to me." And it works. And it's works, and it's dangerous. And social media is enhancing that more than ever before as well.
On that note, Max, come back. Thank you so much, everyone.
Bye.
Tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.